mountains, deserts and streams. The rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. Amima Ahmed is the author of the article entitled Plantae. Studies have shown that interaction with indoor plants can reduce physiological and psychological stress, something customers experience almost immediately when they walk into Chelsea Thomas's lovely space. Chelsea Thomas calls Plantae her COVID project. As a professional backpacking guide, she found herself with a lot of free time when Grand Canyon National Park closed during the pandemic. That, combined with the increasing popularity of houseplants during that time, made it a perfect opportunity for Thomas to embark on a new journey. I had a vision for something that was uniquely houseplants and related items, she recalls. I did a couple of pop-up sales in front of a friend's boutique, and those were wildly successful. Thomas operated as a home-based business for a few months, but soon realized the demand for houseplants was higher than she expected. That led her to expand to a brick-and-mortar location in downtown Flagstaff. Working with indoor plants, though, is nothing new to Thomas. She says she had about 250 houseplants at the beginning of 2020 and has always been interested in gardening and learning about plants. I love the unique variety of houseplants and all the different care methods, she says. I had no professional training. I just seemed to have a knack for indoor plants. Today, that knack has become a thriving, hands-on plant business. Every 2 weeks, Thomas takes a trip to California to select the plants she sells at Plantae. Being in the greenhouse, seeing all the different varieties and all the different plants available, is just really wonderful, she says. I've had so many people tell me that Plantae is the coolest plant shop they've been in, and I think it goes hand in hand with me hand selecting the plants. Rachel Luzada, a Plantae customer from its inception, says walking into the store spurs an immediate feeling of calm and relaxation. You notice all of the amazing plants, local artwork, jewelry, stickers, and ceramics, she says. There are gorgeous pots in all different colors and sizes, cool apparel, soil, trellises, hangers, and everything you need to have happy plants. Lysander also appreciates the highly knowledgeable staff at Plantae. They are friendly and excited to share their expertise, she says. I always learn something new. Taking care of houseplants can be intimidating, but at Plantae, the goal is to help anyone gain the knowledge to own a plant. Even if you kill every plant, we will help you stop doing that, Thomas says. It's a few simple things that you're doing that are causing an issue, and just by learning about it, you can easily fix the problem. Thomas says the main problems people encounter with houseplants are under or overwatering and not providing adequate light. It's really up to the plant holder how much effort they want to put into it, she adds. I would say the biggest learning curve is truly understanding what bright light means to a plant and how a plant's root system works. According to Thomas, a good starting plant for beginners is a golden pothos. It is a quintessential houseplant, she says. This plant is so easy and so adaptable, it can live almost anywhere. Thomas is surrounded by plants at work and at home, and she emphasizes their benefits. It just brightens up your space, she says. It's alive. It gives you purpose. There are so many people who sit at home or at a desk for 8 to 10 hours a day, so it's kind of a way to bring nature indoors. If you're interested in getting started with houseplants, Thomas encourages you to stop by and learn about taking care of them. She and her team at Plantae will have you feeling confident to start your journey as a plant owner. Our tagline says it all. Exceptional houseplants for everyone, she says. You can literally get a plant, a pot, and the knowledge that you need to keep that plant alive just by coming to the shop. Plantae is located at 112 Historic Route 66, Suite 106 in Flagstaff. Phone number 928-440-4264. Website PlantaeFlagstaff.com. Plantae is spelled PLANTAE. And this concludes Plantae. The scenic drive for November 2024 is A Cross Road. Dutch Woman Butte and Bull Mountain are two of the landmarks you'll see on this back road, but the centerpiece is a big lake with up to 128 miles of shoreline. Articles written by Noah Austin. For a reservoir that once was among the world's largest, Theodore Roosevelt Lake doesn't get a ton of attention, possibly because it's been surpassed by, among other human-made bodies of water, Lake Mead and Lake Powell. But while Arizona shares those reservoirs with Nevada and Utah, respectively, Roosevelt remains the largest body of water located entirely in Arizona. A Cross Road, which runs along the north side of the lake, offers a little-seen perspective of it, along with plenty of Sonoran desert scenery. Start this drive along State Route 288, which connects the Globe, Miami area to Pleasant Valley and the Mogollon Rim. At the point where SR 288 transitions from pavement to gravel, head west on A Cross Road, Forest Road 60, a wide Tonto National Forest path that has several rough stretches but is navigable in any SUV. To the north is the Sierra Ancha, a rugged mountain range known for its isolation and numerous archaeological sites. Early on, the road traverses a landscape of healthy saguaro cactuses along with smaller Palo Verde trees, creosote bushes, and prickly pear cactuses. Within a mile, you'll get a look at the reservoir and the four peaks straight ahead. A mile after that, the road crests a hill before gently descending, a pattern you'll repeat several times on this drive. You'll also encounter numerous side roads for exploring the area. The first is Forest Road 88 at mile 2.5. To stay on Forest Road 60, though, bear right. Before long, you'll come to the first of several expansive panoramas of the lake, which was created when Theodore Roosevelt Dam was completed in 1911. When full, the reservoir is 22.4 miles long and has 128 miles of shoreline, and its dam is one of five on the Salt River, which supplies much of the Phoenix area's water supply. Pull over at the hairpin curve at mile 5.2 to get an excellent view of this vital body of water. The road next curves around Bull Mountain, a low-slung butte studded with tall saguaros, before descending into a canyon and passing a quiet ranch property. After crossing a wash and climbing a steep, rocky slope, you'll come to a smoother section and get a look at the Sierra Ancha's Dutch Woman Butte on the right. You'll enjoy intermittent views of the lake for the next several miles, and at mile 15, you'll come to the Salome Canyon trailhead from which the Jug Trail leads into the adjacent Salome Wilderness. A section of prickly pears and yuccas is next, followed by another area dominated by tall saguaros along the road and on the hillside to the right. After a few more lake panoramas, the road continues downhill and enters a rocky, less vegetated landscape of layered buttes that look like distant cousins of those in northern Arizona's Painted Desert. By mile 21, you'll be back among creosote bushes, teddy bear choyas, and a few saguaros, and it's an easy descent from there to a T intersection and a return to the pavement. Turning left would take you to the lake's Indian Point Recreation Site, but you'll turn right to remain on A Cross Road for a mile or so. The road's Tonto Creek crossing is now permanently closed, so at the Y intersection at mile 24, bear right onto Klein Boulevard, which crosses the normally dry creek just before ending at State Route 188 in Tonto Basin. Turn right to reach Payson or the Phoenix area, or turn left for another look at a lake that always has more to see. And this concludes A Cross Road. The hike of the month for November 2024 is Bell Trail. Like so many of the trails in Red Rock Country, the Bell Trail is an option any time of year, but the best time might be autumn when the cottonwoods turn to gold. Articles written by Robert Steve. There's no definitive set of variables that define a perfect hike. It varies from person to person and place to place. In the arid Southwest, water is an important element. Scenery, accessibility, and difficulty are part of it too, and so is a nice payoff. By those measures, the Bell Trail would seem to have it all. What's more, it's doable any time of year, and the best time might be autumn when the riparian canopy of cottonwoods and sycamores turns to gold. The only downside is the foot traffic, which can be heavy at times. But if you go on a weekday, you'll find plenty of solitude, and getting there is easy. The trailhead is located a stone's throw from the Sedona exit off Interstate 17. Actually, there are two trailheads, which can be a little confusing. The first is the Bruce Brockett Trailhead, which features a large parking area that can accommodate horse trailers. It's good for RVs, too, but anyone can park there. From the lot, there's a short connector trail that leads to the Bell Trail. The primary trailhead, however, is a quarter mile farther down the road. There's a restroom and plenty of parking. From that lot, the trail begins as a wide, rocky, red dirt path. Almost immediately, you'll start to hear the sounds of Wet Beaver Creek, which runs year-round and is home to smallmouth bass and trout. About 10 miles in, the trail dips down and passes through a fence. To the south is the riparian area, one of the most beautiful in Arizona, and to the north is a hillside covered with grasses and prickly pear cactuses. If the sun is shining and the time is right, the plants look as if they're being illuminated with fiber optics. A few minutes later, you'll arrive at an intersection with the Bruce Brockett Trail, which leads to the Horse Trailer Lot and is named for the late poet, politician, and cattleman who owned the surrounding V Bar V Ranch. The ranch was acquired by the Coconino National Forest in 1994, and a portion of it was preserved as the V Bar V Heritage Site. Today, that area, about a mile down the road, is known as the Crane Petroglyph Heritage Site, and it protects one of the largest and best-preserved petroglyph sites in the Verde Valley. Continuing on, you'll come to the first of several short spurs that lead to the creek. A few minutes later, there's a second spur, followed by an intersection with the White Mesa Trail, which runs north for about a mile toward its namesake. 10 minutes after that, you'll come to an intersection with the Apache Made Trail, a strenuous route that runs northeast past Casner Butte at 5,121 feet. Just beyond that junction, the trail crosses into the Wet Beaver Wilderness, which was established in 1984 and protects 6,178 acres. Visually, the landscape doesn't change much, but the trail shifts from mostly level to a gradual ascent. It's not a strenuous climb, but it's enough to get your attention. Keep in mind, the ascent will fool you at times. More than once, you'll think you've arrived at the high point of the hike, only to turn a corner and see that there's more uphill ahead. After a half mile of descent, you'll arrive at a narrow bench that runs along the canyon's north wall. The trail levels off briefly and passes some spectacular ocotillos, like something you'd see in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains. After that, it starts climbing again until it reaches an elevation of 4,265 feet, the official high point. From there, the single track drops into the canyon and arrives at Wet Beaver Creek at a place known as Bell's Crossing. Although the Bell Trail continues uphill for another 3.2 miles to an intersection with a long canyon trail, this is where most folks turn around. Big trees shade the water, creating an oasis that's best known for the Crack, a natural pool that was listed in National Geographic Adventure as one of the nation's best swimming holes. Sadly, that great magazine is no longer in print, but the Crack remains, and it's a payoff on a trail that seems to have it all. And this concludes Bell Trail. With text by Tom Kuhn, the next article is entitled Canoe Quest. Defeated by the unexpected wind that threatened to blow us back up the Colorado River, we beached the canoe in shelter for the night behind a screen of salt cedars. 12 miles is all we managed, half the distance hoped for on day one. Photographer Jim Marshall and I are on a 4-day, 69-mile paddle that will take us from the Interstate 10 bridge at Ehrenberg downstream to Martinez Lake near Imperial Dam, the last long navigable stretch of the Colorado River before it is siphoned off to Arizona and California farms and homes. We plan stops on both the Arizona and California sides at archaeological sites, pioneer cabins, and old mines. Early April is generally a good time to canoe the lower Colorado. We expected flat water and lazy eddies and forgot to bring a good map. At the Ehrenberg put-in, we shifted carefully, searching for the canoe's balance. With the bag of soft drinks tied behind, we began like two guys on a picnic, the 13-foot canoe burdened deep in the water with its load. A large man, Marshall, supplied forward ballast. Between us lay gear bags, ammo cans, protected cameras, and film. When the wind drove the canoe backward over the drink toe, we pulled in. It was April Fool's Day. The free map we carried was unreliable. We weren't sure where we were. The morning of day two brought light winds scented with citrus blossoms from a California orchard. A 3.5-mile-per-hour current pulls at the canoe's bottom, compelling us downstream. 15-foot walls of rock riprap that armors the Arizona and California banks for most of the first 35 miles imprison not only the 125-yard-wide river, but us. Around a bend, we catch up to 11 Boy Scouts and leaders from San Diego, the first people we've encountered on the river, drifting in wood and canvas kayaks they'd built. Head Scoutmaster Michael T. Bovis, a U.S. Navy non-com, paddling a canoe, invites us to join them on the shore. The scouts have made about 25 miles in 2 days. We camp in places like this, Bovis says, taking in the thin beach fronting a thicket of arrowwood. It doesn't matter which side of the river. The previous night, they had a close encounter with the river. Water had lapped close to their camp after rising 4 feet after releases from the Parker Hydroelectric Dam 100 miles upstream. By chance alone, Marshall and I ended up on high ground. We part and the scouts fall behind. By midday, the wind builds. We learn later that winds frequently blow on the river, big muscle winds that race easterly across California farmland and north from Mexico before heading full bore upstream. Along the California bank, we find a meager lee to shelter us from the walloping winds now leaping like fury over the arrowwood and cane growing from the riprap. My left arm touches water with each dip of the paddle. We have 5 inches of stern freeboard, yet we're flying downstream at about 7 miles per hour and soon reach mile 22 at the Oxbow Bridge crossing. A camper with a river map shows us we are 12 miles from our rendezvous at Walters Landing, California, with outfitters Robert V. Smokey Knowlton and Judy Key of Martinez Lake. Walters Landing, where the riprap finally ends, is a popular canoe put-in. Knowlton 62 and Key 51 arrive in a powerboat with a 21-foot canoe lashed to the stern to guide us through the Cibola and Imperial National Wildlife Refuge. Although we have already paddled 25 miles, Knowlton urges us back on the water and, bucking a stiff wind, we cross to the Arizona side, tied to arrowwood cane and hike in the Cibola Refuge to a heap of melted adobe overlooking Cibola Lake. The remains of 49er W.D. Wood's 1860s cattle spread. Rude made a lot of money selling cattle but shunned banks. After he drowned on April 29, 1870, near where we crossed, treasure hunters descended on his place, pocking it with digging. Legend claims that Rude's ghost still gallops about the area. Near Gale Force Wind talks at us as we walk wild burro trails across cobblestone flats back to the river. By now, 3-foot curl waves are marching upstream through a riot of whitecaps that recall the day of Rude's death. According to an historical count, with a heavy gale blowing and the river rising rapidly, he went under while the foreman barely made the shore by clinging to the boat. I figure one ghost is enough and refuse to get back into the canoe. Day 3 dawns on a flat river, but a cold front arriving overnight threatens rain. On the river, I shake in layers of summer weight clothing. The ducks and geese are gone, but herons and merganseers fly up before us. At mile 41, a faint trail from the California bank takes us to the J.C. Draper Cabin, an 1890s homestead within the 25,125-acre Imperial Refuge. Wild burro trails, dung mounds, and plant damage they cause abound. The burros are feral descendants of pack animals released by early miners. 2 years ago, Nolan and Key drove powerboats to haul out 200 burros caught in an emergency environmental protection roundup by U.S. Bureau of Land Management cowboys in the hills beyond the Draper Cabin. Protected by federal law, the burros were given for adoption. Poking like a hound's tooth from the river silt at mile 42, Lighthouse Rock provides an unmistakable landmark. The rock was named by the Ides expedition, which steamed up the river in a 54-foot stern wheeler in 1857. The Arizona shore here is known as Paradise Valley, and on a maze of burrow trails through cane thickets, Knowlton leads us to derelict pump machinery and an early farmhouse site sprinkled with dish fragments. A short distance away, beneath a bluff, we find chiseled into boulders glazed brown with a patina of desert varnish, a gallery of ancient petroglyphs, evidence the place once had mystical value for the predecessors of modern Mojaves and Ketchins. The petroglyphs have endured for centuries. However, federal officials say that burros, rolling to dust themselves, destroy old Indian sleeping circles, and their hooves erase ancient Indian footpaths along the river. With the wind at our backs now, we race to mile 48, where a California fisherman brags of a 7-pound striped bass. In the deep holes along the lower Colorado lurk real tackle busters, stripers topping 50 pounds, 60-pound flathead catfish prized for their white flesh, 30-pound channel cats. The river record for largemouth bass is 16 pounds, 14 ounces. Easter weekend is just a few days off, yet most campgrounds are empty in California's Picacho State Recreation Area, which fronts the river for 9 miles. At a campsite opposite Hogue Rock, a granite monolith on the Arizona bank where cables were once anchored to ferry horse-drawn wagons across, we appraise the weather, and it doesn't look good for 4 people with only 1 3-person tent. We decide to continue to Norton's Landing, 5 miles farther, a mound near mile 52 where silver ore from nearby mines was crushed and loaded onto steamboats. We eat wind all the way, arriving at shelter just ahead of an all-night rainstorm. At 5:30 a.m. on day 4, the rain and wind halt abruptly, and a honking chorus of wild burros welcomes the return of spring. It's time to go back on the river. Civilization appears off starboard at mile 56. At his concession at the end of a boat slip 27 miles east of Winter Haven, California, Dave Jensen sells everything except alcoholic drinks and gas. April and May are his busiest months, he says, with 50 to 75 canoeists stopping by on a weekend. In June, it starts to get warm, he says. We also get some in July, people who are tough and can take the hot weather. Temperatures often top 110 degrees. Ice cream is a big seller, Jensen says. Under a hot sun, off come some layers of clothes. At mile 59, a narrow channel leads to Cabin Lake, a backwater along the Arizona shore in the Imperial Refuge. We stop to explore Watchman's Cabin, a one-room shack with a reed-thatched roof near the old Riverview gold mine. The others go off searching while I commandeer a chair on the cabin's porch. I'm startled when 2 uniformed men step into the clearing. I take a quick inventory. Fishing license? Required safety equipment? U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officers James E. Ferrier, assigned to the Imperial Refuge headquarters at Martinez Lake, and Kyle J. Todd of Mission Valley, Montana, on a 4-month detail to Arizona, aren't interested in us. They are after no-wash violators in the backwaters, where Ferrier explained, a wave can topple nests. They warn we've arrived in the power zone. On the holiday weekends of Easter, Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day, Ferrier says, 5,000 powerboats towing skiers may jam the 20-mile stretch of the Colorado between Dave Jensen's store and Imperial Dam. Back on the mainstream, fast-moving powerboats growl by, rocking our boats with their wakes. One zips 50 feet past Knowlton and Key's canoe. That really spooked me, Key says later. But our paddle is almost over. At mile 68, we leave the mainstream heading north across a mile of Martinez Lake, a broad, deep backwater in Arizona where waterfront lots sell for astonishing prices. Once again, we face off with the wind. Although we're 30 pounds of food and drink lighter and riding higher in the water now, a formidable 2-foot chop threatens to founder us. When we finally grind against the shore, we're relieved to still be dry. We'd expected an easy paddle. We ended up arm wrestling a river with unpredictable moods. And this concludes Canoe Quest. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
Mountains, deserts, and streams rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.